On this week's 51%, we learn about an organization offering community to children impacted by incarceration and deportation.
Someone gets taken away, and it's children and it's parents, and it's like this whole extended world of people who are impacted.
WAMC's Samantha Simmons also speaks with author Megan Smith about how she found love again in the wake of grief. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our main guests today are personally familiar with the impacts of incarceration and deportation on children. It's a pretty timely subject right now, as the federal government ramps up deportations nationwide that are separating families, sometimes at a moment's notice. Amy Friedman says this separation has a profound impact on kids and teens, and she spent years trying to give them a safe space to navigate their emotions. Friedman is a former columnist and activist who fell in love with and married an incarcerated man. She saw firsthand how their daughters struggled with their father's absence and how they felt alone in their situation. Almost a decade later, after a divorce and marriage to another man, Friedman still remembered that. And she set out to start a support group for kids at a local school. That club, called the POPS, or Pain in Our Prison System Club, became very popular, and in time Friedman had chapters across the U.S. In addition to offering students a safe space, POPS encouraged kids to use art as an outlet, and the group regularly publishes anthologies of students' work, with Friedman as the editor. POPS merged with a similar nonprofit, the Pathfinder Network, in Portland, Oregon, in 2022. I recently spoke with Friedman and Pathfinder member Tyler Stonebreaker, a high school student, about what it's like to have a loved one in prison and their latest art collection called Home and Away.
One in 14 children in the United States has a parent who is or has been incarcerated. And so then, you know, you expand that out to people who have siblings or boyfriends and girlfriends or uncles and aunts or other loved ones. It's a massive number, which means any classroom you go into, you'll find that population. Mostly we don't know about it because it's such a stigma and people, you know, especially right now, it's a pretty momentous time for those dealing with immigration issues. One day I had this, it was kind of like a brainstorm. Like, what about starting a club? And really, the idea was just start a club in one school. It would be a place where people could find out, A, they're not alone. My daughters always felt like they were the only ones. I knew they weren't, but they felt like they were. B, where they felt support, they felt seen, they felt heard. It was a safe space for them to be able to speak. And also, because my husband and I are both writers, we wanted to offer this artistic expression opportunity. And we decided very early on that we were going to publish the work that they produced, art and writing, in a beautiful format, in a professional way, and honor them. The story is the first day of the first club meeting, of the first, you know, just this was February 13th, 2013. The first girl who walked in the room was a 10th grader, and she picked up her peanut butter and jelly sandwich. We always have food. She sat down, and the second girl who walked in the room, also a 10th grader, picked up her sandwich, looked across the room, saw this woman. They ran to each other. And I found out later that day that they had been close friends since they were in kindergarten. They knew all kinds of things about each other. They were pals. What they didn't know is that each of them had a father who was incarcerated. I heard that, and you know, it was kind of one of those moments, and I said, I know what we'll do. We'll start a nonprofit and we'll spread this to every school in America. And it was profoundly effective. Since that time, about 2.5 years ago, a group of researchers have, under an NIH grant, may disappear, but have been doing studies of these groups in and comparing them with general population in the schools where they are and discovering how effective they are. I'm sort of not allowed to say out loud all the very specific research findings because they're not yet published, but it's been profound. And I still have that dream that it will just be everywhere.
I gotta say, I love the idea of formally publishing these works. You know, I still remember when I was young, really young, like less than 10 years old, my aunt got me a gift for my birthday one year, and it was essentially a picture book kit. You know, you can make your own picture book, mail it back, and they would bind it and put a professional cover on it. And just, you know, to this day, I think that's still one of the coolest gifts I've ever gotten, you know, as a kid to be able to see my work published in that way. And, you know, to sort of hopping on a little bit of what you said there about honoring these experiences, I think giving them this kind of platform does exactly that.
You know, teenagers don't get listened to much. And I have learned so much from these kids who I'm almost embarrassed to call them kids. They've all experienced a lot. I think we all need to know what they have to say, particularly these young people who are experiencing, we're a carceral state. We need to know about what we're doing to families. And I mean, to make it, you know, perfectly relevant, I keep thinking about Abrego Garcia's children. And those are people we don't think about, we don't hear from, we don't know what's going on for them. The books aren't purely about their experience with the carceral system. Like they're about, you know, what's going on for you in your life. But I think they're enlightening.
Well, on that note, Tyler, are you in home in a way? Tell me a little bit more about your involvement in Pathfinder and what it's meant for you.
I'm in this edition, and then I've also was in the last year's book too. And like my involvement with the Pathfinder Club, when I joined, like I wasn't too sure about it because I didn't really know what it was. But like I started realizing that it's like a place that I could fully be myself and like not hide it. Because before that, I like felt kind of like embarrassed about like the things I have to go through, and so like I'd mask it with pretending like nothing's happening, like at school and like with my friends. But since I joined, I've been able to just be myself. It feels great to have our writings published because before that, I feel like I had nothing to be proud of. It feels great to be have something to be proud of myself about.
Is writing your preferred medium?
Yeah, it is. I sometimes do drawing, but it's mainly like writing and music. I think it's like three pieces in the book, Heartbreak and Dreams. My homies are gone. With those pieces, I talked like about the grief I was going through at the time because during the time of writing the book, I lost a lot of people. It's close to like seven. So, I just wrote about like the grief and what I was like feeling about the road at the time.
Amy, what kinds of feelings and situations do you see kids often navigating in these works?
It depends on the year. Generally speaking, the way that the titles come and the sort of breakdown of what the book looks like comes out of what I'm getting from the kids they're submitting. Themes start to appear. So in this volume, for instance, it's called Home and Away because again and again, work that I was getting was revolving around one of two things, not every single piece, but many, many, many of them around what home was. Sometimes it was club. You know, sometimes people were writing about being in club feels like home, and this feels like my family, and all that kind of thing. Or home and what happens, you know, how homes are being disrupted, or homes feel safe, or school is like home, or all of that kind of thing. And then the away piece was people taken away, people lost, like Tyler experienced a lot of loss, or going away, you know, sometimes like. When I go away, when I travel, I'm free. And whereas this upcoming book, the theme seems to be weirdly music. What I sensed in a lot of the pieces was the comfort of music. There's a real sense of discomfort and sorrow and fear. And music just kept kind of coming through or elements of music, chords and keys and all that. So different things happen at different times. The volume during COVID, just after COVID, is called Dear Friends. And that was, people were submitting work that was all about the friends they missed and how much they needed their friends and what was, you know. So the writing is very, and the artwork contains a lot. It travels all over the place. But themes do seem to come out of the times.
This could be a question for both of you, I guess, but what do you feel people commonly misunderstand about having a loved one who's been incarcerated or deported?
You want to start, Tyler, or you want me to?
Yeah, I can start. I feel like what's misunderstood is like when I tell people that don't have people that they know incarcerated, that these are people that have like feelings, they have a heart. It just, their circumstances is what made them who they are. It's just that they're people too.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, for sure that's true. And I would add, it's so easy to convince people that, like, if it, you know, the minute you say someone was detained or someone was deported or someone was locked up, it's so easy to convince people that, oh, they must be a terrible person. There must be something just broken in them. I remember the first time I started going to prisons, I just would every single time think, there but for the grace of God. It was like the stories again are so many and so different, and circumstances so often lead people to make mistakes and get caught and pay a price. And I think the other thing that people don't think about is how many people are affected. That you're talking about, someone gets taken away, and it's children and it's parents, and it's like this whole extended world of people who are impacted. And I think one of the most powerful set of stories I've ever read is about a few young women who had lost their brothers to long prison sentences, and these were their big brothers who they loved and adored. And what happened in one, there's one story that I thought was so powerful, because this young woman came to Pops and didn't want to talk and didn't want to write, and she was kind of a little pissed off. And her brother had gone to prison. She was now about 14 or 15, and he'd gone to prison when she was 9 or 10, and she hadn't spoken to him because she was mad at him because of what he had done to her. Somebody suggested, why, you know, write him a letter that you're not going to send him. She wrote it and she sent it, and it brought them back together. And it was like this amazing healing of the whole family. But when someone goes away, it's so easy to lose connection, and it's so painful. And I don't think anybody thinks about that. And when a kid loses a parent to death, they're surrounded by wreaths and comfort and love and compassion and understanding and blessings. And when someone loses a parent to prison, they're, oh, I keep thinking about, it gives me chills, but I keep thinking about what Attorney General Bondi just said about Abrego Garcia's children and wife, that they're better off. It just sends chills up and down my spine, you know.
Yeah, I imagine it's a scary time right now as the government is ramping up deportations. You know, if someone you know is being impacted, what would you recommend you do to help?
One thing I would say is reach out, ask what you can do, acknowledge that you're aware that they must be going through something. There are many, many young people involved with our organization who are DACA or, you know, otherwise involved with undocumented loved ones. And I think the most important thing is to ask them what they need and how you can help. You know, not to pretend like you can't talk about it. And I just parenthetical to that, in these books, you know, kids are allowed to write with pen names or anonymously. And I will note that the anonymous submissions this year multiplied, well, understandably. But there's a lot of people out there who could use love, attention, asking how you can help. I keep coming to this. There's a prompt we often use, which is I come from. And the Pathfinder Club that Tyler is in wrote a joint I come from piece. So it was everybody in the club. So I would love to read at least part of it. It's long, but would that be okay?
Yeah, of course.
Awesome. So I come from the Pathfinder Club of Park Rose High School, Portland, Oregon. I come from households where I am afraid the people around me might not come home. I come from silent treatment and quiet fights. I come from a family of four. I come from a place where fear will get you killed. I come from a hardworking family with dysfunction and love. I come from a home overlooking the beautiful sunrise that makes me wish every morning that I was in London. I come from a home with unstable conditions and a cherry tree house. I come from the courage and strength of my immigrant abuela. I come from a lot of thinking, 11 siblings with different moms. I come from not knowing when to bite my tongue. I come from fried chicken. I come from fear that made me fierce. I come from a struggling family. I come from people who care. I come from sitting alone at my home. I come from years of wanting to get out. I come from beautiful, strong women who teach me life lessons while smoking a Black and Mild.
Amy Friedman is the founder of the POPS, or Pain in Our Prison System Club, which offers a safe space for students with loved ones who have been incarcerated or deported. The club merged with the similar club nonprofit Pathfinder Network in 2022, of which Tyler Stonebreaker is a member. Friedman is also the editor of the nonprofit's annual anthology of student work. The latest edition is titled Home and Away. You can learn more at Pathfinder's website, thepathfindernetwork.org. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you, Jesse.
Widows can love again. That's what Capital Region author Megan Smith says, and it's the title of her new book. After losing her husband, Mikey Campbell, to cancer in 2020, she thought she may not find happiness again. Smith says she was afraid about being herself again, but a few months later, a motorcycle-loving single parent, Kevin, came into her life, showing her the compassion she was missing. Smith and Kevin now live in Colony, New York, with their two kids. Smith writes about how she and her now husband deal with survivor's guilt and recover from the trauma of being a caregiver to her late husband. WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with Smith about how she came to love again while keeping Mikey's legacy alive.
Why did you decide to write a book about it?
A couple reasons. Ever since I was a little girl, I've always had a dream of writing a book one day. And as an English teacher, I always had it on the back of my mind. But I think one of my main reasons is to help others who have gone through what I've gone through as a caregiver, as somebody dealing with hard grief, and a caregiver to their spouse, as a mom, and all of those elements. So I'm hoping that I can help widows, widowers, caregivers, anybody who is grieving, and so that we can start conversation about these things that most people don't really talk about because they are so hard. But in a way, I found that it's healing to talk about these things.
In the book, you repeated and you really drive the point home that the toll of being a caregiver was a lot for you. And I sympathize with you. My family and I take care of my grandmother, and we've taken care of other relatives in the past. And you called your mom the caregiver for the caregiver. She's a nurse herself, I found out while reading the book. And for those who might not understand this, can you explain like the weight of being a caregiver and how your mom was able to support you and she continues to support you?
As a caregiver, I think it was the hardest job I've ever had. You give your entire self to the person that you're caring for, making doctor's appointments, making sure his medicines are ready in the morning, and helping this person survive really is your job. It took a toll on me immensely. I also had a full-time job. I was working for our family business as administrative assistant. So this was a third job. And I had to balance being a caregiver, a mom, my career, and a wife all in one. So I lost my identity, which I explain in the book pretty much in detail, that I kind of lost who I was. And I had one purpose, and that was to make sure my husband was going to survive. I didn't realize that until afterwards, until he was no longer with us, how much I lost myself.
In the book, you mention your faith in God and heaven a lot. How did your faith help you through this?
Oh, sometimes it was the only thing I held on to is hope and praying. And so when I would pray, that would also distract me from whatever we were going through at the time. God was there through the end. And I think that's what has gotten me through after his passing as well, is knowing that he is in eternal life.
How did your relationship with Mikey change as you became his caregiver instead of just the sole focus of being his wife?
As a caregiver in a marriage, it takes a toll on your marriage, especially in the romance department. It's very difficult and trying. Your spouse is basically just trying to survive, and you put aside all of the things that are normal aspects of marriage, and it's just your goal to live, and my job was to help him live.
Is that something you guys ever discussed, how your relationship changed?
We did, yes. So we sought therapy, which I'm a huge believer in seeking therapy when you have struggles in your life. And so we had a couples therapist who specialized in medicinal areas. And so she helped us in the marriage aspect while battling cancer.
While you were writing the book, or after, now that it's done, was there anything you found out about yourself or realized about his care that you wish you could share with him now?
I don't think I'd change anything. I have no regrets about my care for him or how things were handled. I think the one thing which I discuss in the book, I probably would have changed the location of where he passed, because I had to move out of our house, and that was a struggle for me, but it all worked out in the end. But I think maybe that would be the only thing that I would second guess.
You discuss Mikey's last moments surrounded by his family, but it's not until the end of the book that you talk about the day of his services. Why did you make that distinguishment?
So as I was writing, I was coming up to his 1-year anniversary of his passing, and I felt it would be a great transition to have a flashback to that actual day of his services and then living it without him there on that day. And so that's kind of how I structure that in my book. And it was also, writing my book was a journey in itself, and I didn't know where it was going. So it just happened to find the perfect place right there.
Let's talk about Kevin. Mm. Introduce him to us, please.
Kevin is my knight in shining armor. He is an amazing person who has a level of understanding that I never knew existed, especially with providing me morning space and knowing that there will always be another man that I loved and will still love for the rest of our lives. And the way that he loves my children as if they are his own is pretty remarkable and priceless.
How is your love with Kevin different than it was with Mikey?
There wasn't this negative dark cloud hanging over our relationship, whereas I was a healing process when I met Kevin, and he actually was a crutch to my healing.
On page 34, you wrote, "I struggle with doing anything for myself that I love to do. The guilt suffocated me." And then later on, you wrote, "How could I be happy when he wasn't here?" Mikey encouraged you to continue on with your life and do things that make you happy. But how are you feeling now? And do you still experience survivor's guilt when loving Kevin?
Yeah, survivor's guilt was a whole other aspect of grieving that I did not expect. And I learned about through my own therapy after Mikey passed away. I do not have survivor's guilt anymore. I got through that stage. But it is, it's very strong, and you feel like you cannot be happy again. And you are afraid to be in a relationship again. And you have all of these fears of what society and the community is going to think of you when you fall in love again. And so all of these things are going through your brain. But I think one of the reasons why I wrote this book is to help others, widows, widowers, anybody else who needs to move, take that step, but they're afraid to explain to them that it is okay to move on. It is okay to be happy again. You will always remember your past love who passed away. And you're even more in luck when you find a partner who allows for that mourning space and loves you for you and the man who you used to love.
Lastly, can we talk about Bella?
Sure.
How is she doing with all this? She was, I think, somewhere between 6 and 8 when Mikey passed away. And I think when the book was being written, she was older. So that's like the more 8 years old part. She's a little bit older than that now, but
yeah.
How is she handling it? How did she handle moving in with Kevin and his son and all of the change that comes with a parent?
So, she was 7 when he passed away, and she struggled at first, especially in school. I organized for a therapist to be available for her if she ever needed to step out of the classroom, and I talked to her teachers about that and let her know she can do that. She has the permission to do that, and I think her moving out of our old house was a challenge for her, which is what I discuss in the book as well. But I also explained to her that in order for mommy to find peace and happiness again, this is what we have to do for this time period. And the house will always be there if you want to go visit it. And now she's, you know, I think by her witnessing her father in such a fragile state and how long he fought for, 5 years. I think her witnessing that at such a young age has provided her with a strength I have never witnessed in my adult years for a 12-year-old girl to persevere. Mikey gave her the gift of perseverance by portraying to her that she can be strong through anything.
That was Megan Smith, author of Widows Can Love Again, speaking with WAMC's Samantha Simmons. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete. Sweet melting little girl dreams. They said, oh, taking me, where are you taking me? City.